not only the first PEARS Institute webinar of the term, but it's the first PEARS Institute academic scholars webinar ever. I'm really absolutely thrilled that we have as our speaker today, Michael Rothberg. Michael is the professor of English and comparative literature and the 1939 Society Samuel Gertz Chair in Holocaust Studies at the University of California in Los Angeles. A leading scholar and public intellectual, he writes at the intersection of Holocaust studies, memory studies, and post-colonial studies. And in fact, it's not too much to say that his work has been crucial and formative in actually forging the intersection of these fields, which are ever more important. Among his publications are Multidirectional Memory, Remembering the Holocaust in the Age of Decolonization, and published in 2009, and 2019, The Implicated Subject, Beyond Victims and Perpetrators. Today, Michael will speak for 25 or 30 minutes, and then he and I will have a short conversation, and then we'll open it, open up the event to wider questions. So please I put your questions in the chat or in the Q&A box, and I will do my best to pick them up. Michael's title today, as you probably know, but it's customary, so I'll remind you of it. Michael's title is Comparing Comparisons, Preliminary Reflections on a New Era of Historical Analogy, and I, for one, am extremely eager to hear it. Michael.
Thank you. Thank you so much, David. I hope everybody can hear me. It's a real pleasure to be here. I'm grateful to David for the invitation and happy to be part of this PEARS Institute event, and grateful to everyone who helped make it possible at the Institute. As I said to David, and as I kind of signaled in my title and in my abstract for the talk, this is sort of a preliminary talk. I want to kind of think through some things and do it in a somewhat informal way. And I hope that there really will be some time for conversation as we go along. I'm going to share my screen, and I'm going to use PowerPoint here for at least the first part of the talk, and then probably turn it off and talk through the later part of the talk. So hopefully you can see that now. So I think it's no secret that over the last 4 years, there's been a kind of proliferation of historical comparisons, certainly in the US and Europe, and I actually think more globally, between the current political conjuncture and the events of the interwar period, and especially interwar fascism. These comparisons are obviously ubiquitous, and I've been thinking about them for a long time. But what I'm thinking about in a new way, and what I want to kind of put forward today, is a notion that sometimes these comparisons lead to what I've started to call comparison controversies. And I want to start to think a little bit about this notion of the comparison controversy as a kind of discursive genre, or maybe a kind of discursive event type. So that's the part that's sort of new for me, and that I'm trying to think through a little bit. Now, comparison is also not new at all. And though I do think something has shifted in the last 4 years, a lot of these comparison controversies, and certainly ubiquitous comparisons, go back a lot further. So I'm not claiming that anything here is absolutely new at all. But I do want to reflect a little bit on our particular moment, and also think about that moment in relationship to earlier moments. So for example, when David Feldman invited me to talk, one of the things he noted was that there's been a recent shift in thinking about anti-Semitism from comparative juxtaposition with Islamophobia toward new comparisons or resurgent comparisons with anti-Blackness and anti-Black racism. I think there's certainly something to that. And some of that will, I think, appear in my talk as I go along. So my position is that comparison is neither good nor bad. It's simply a fundamental part of human cognition, right? So we necessarily compare, we juxtapose, we put things in relation, we perceive patterns, we notice distinctions, right? So because of this inevitability of comparison, we need to be able to assess and to distinguish between different kinds of comparisons, it strikes me. And so in earlier work, I developed or started to develop what I call an ethics of comparison. And this was around my work on multidirectional memory, and particularly about an earlier comparison controversy, an ongoing one really, but the one that kind of prompted me to think this through was in response to the Israeli bombing of Gaza in 2008, 2009, which led to a whole host of comparisons, which especially around Gaza, the analogy of Gaza and Warsaw. And so in an essay called From Gaza to Warsaw, which is now in my most recent book, The Implicated Subject, I kind of created what I called a map of multidirectional memory or a schema for thinking about the ethics of comparison, where I decided that we need to think about comparison on two axes, what I call the axis of comparison itself, which stretches between equation of different histories and a kind of radical distinction or differentiation between histories. And then what I called an axis of political affect. What was the question there is, for what are these comparisons made? Are they made in a kind of competitive move? Were they made in the interest of creating solidarity? And once you set up those two axes, as you can see, you've got four quadrants. And this is a relatively crude distinction, but it gives you sort of a start in sorting out some of these kinds of historical comparisons. Now, we may touch on some of this today, but today I want to take a slightly different approach in approaching these comparison controversies. And so what I'm proposing here is that we need a comparative methodology for thinking about comparison. In other words, we need to compare comparisons. We need to juxtapose different cases. And the talk then is going to have two parts, and hopefully, if I have time, for both. And the first, in the first part, I'm going to think about this most recent era a little bit and just go through a couple of fairly well-known examples, or I think fairly well-known examples, and then offer a few observations about what's been happening here in these most recent historical comparisons to fascism, to the Holocaust, to the interwar period. And then, and I'm mostly going to be focusing here on the U.S. context or examples from the U.S. context, so I think you can extrapolate to other contexts as well. And in the second part of the talk, again, assuming there's enough time, I want to touch a little bit on a particular German case and do a kind of diachronic comparison there. So we'll come to that in a moment. So let me start with what was, I believe, a pretty well-known example, at least in the U.S., which took place in June of 2019, which feels like it was about 20 years ago at this point. And this was a moment when the Trump administration, moment that continues, was holding migrants and asylum seekers from Central America at the Mexican-American U.S. border in really abominable conditions in detention camps. And Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, known as AOC, one of the most progressive Congress people in the U.S., tweeted this tweet that you can see on the screen. The administration has established concentration camps on the southern border of the United States for immigrants, where they are being brutalized with dehumanizing conditions and dying. This is not hyperbole. It is the conclusion of expert analysis. AOC, not so surprisingly, got a lot of pushback on this claim. She also, in a live broadcast, used the phrase never again to talk about the camps that were being established. And the response was pretty immediate and turned into what I'm calling a comparison controversy. And there was pushback both from conservative politicians, but also, I thought interestingly, from institutions associated with Holocaust education and Holocaust memory. And so here on the bottom, you see the Simon Wiesenthal Center tweeting back at her. And then it kind of attained a new level when the U.S. Holocaust Museum in Washington issued a statement partly in response to AOC, partly in response to a statement that had been released by someone affiliated with the museum, in which, as you can see, they unequivocally reject efforts to create analogies between the Holocaust and other events, whether historical or contemporary. This was a radical position and really a kind of rewriting of the very reason for being of the museum, which was always set up as a both an educational and commemorative and also scholarly institution that promoted comparative genocide studies, that wanted people to think about the potential efficacy of Holocaust memory in the present in confronting other sorts of atrocities. So it was a very strange statement, I think, for many of us who knew anything about the Holocaust Museum and its history. And in response then to that statement, Andrea Orzov and Annika Valka, two colleagues in Holocaust studies, drafted a very strong letter, which ended up being signed by close to 600 scholars, really virtually everybody in the field of Holocaust studies, in which they said basically what I just said, I think, in response to the Holocaust Museum statement, that this is a really a radical position that's outside the mainstream of scholarship on the Holocaust and on genocide, and that it would make scholarship, in fact, essentially impossible if we didn't think in comparative and analogical terms. And as the letter specifies, this is relevant both for Holocaust education, for Holocaust memory, and also for Holocaust scholarship, kind of across the board. So this was one sort of prominent example of what I'm calling a comparison controversy. And of course, these have continued, and you can pick your favorite examples. Just a few weeks ago, the Jewish Democratic Council of America released a campaign ad, anti-Trump campaign ad, obviously, and it's a video in which they juxtapose images from 1930s Germany, Nazi Germany, and the contemporary US. You see here on the right side of your screen an image from Charlottesville. I'll come back to that example in a moment. And of course, or in any case, they too got pushback here from the Anti-Defamation League and the American Jewish Committee. Offensive comparisons between 2020 America and 1930s Germany distract from the urgent need to fight Jew hatred. They also trivialize the memories of both victims and survivors. So again, just an ongoing set of comparison controversies, referencing the Nazi period, referencing fascism, referencing the Holocaust sometimes. There's more to be said about all of these, but I just want to keep us sort of moving, just offer a few observations about this kind of event in recent times. The first is that although, as the case of AOC and maybe the Jewish Democratic Council would seem to suggest, it's often the comparison of this sort is often a kind of weapon of the left or sometimes of liberals against the right. In fact, there's been a very robust debate going on within the left. And I think this is interesting. And I think it's actually taking place both within what you could genuinely call the left and also on the more liberal, in the American sense, more liberal side of the political spectrum. I think in both of those areas, you see sort of pro and anti-comparison positions being staked out. Among the most prominent, at least for intellectuals, has been a kind of ongoing discussion that's taken place across this year in the pages of sort of serious journal magazines and journals like the New York Review of Books or in the UK and the New Statesman, sometimes pitting friends and colleagues against each other, as in this sort of debate between Peter Gordon and Samuel Moyn. Gordon's essay in this case actually came out first, Why Historical Analogy Matters, and it was a kind of response to the left anti-comparison position, represented by people like Corey Robin, the political theorist, and also Samuel Moyn, the historian and legal scholar, and again, friend and colleague of Gordon's. Moyn then responded with an essay called The Trouble with Comparisons a few months later, earlier this year. Again, it seems like 10 years ago, but it was just May. Just to give you a little bit of a sense of what was at stake in this debate on the left. So Moyn writes, comparison to Nazism and fascism imminently threatening to topple democracy distracts us from how we have made how we made Trump over decades and implies that the coexistence of our democracy with long histories of killing, subjugation, and terror was somehow less worth the alarm and opprobrium. So the idea here on the left is that the references to fascism, to Nazism, to European history, in a sense, takes away from this actual American legacy of white supremacy and racism, and seems to suggest that there's something completely new about Trump when in fact he emerges out of decades of conservative and even liberal politics. In response, Gordon's position is that this kind is a kind of inverted American exceptionalism, right? Not wanting to see the links between US history and, say, European fascism. And that is also a kind of policing of the phrase never again and the scope of never again, right? Which, as Gordon concludes, if the phrase never again contains a broader warning, it must apply across time and space, all right? So we have to be able to make these kinds of analogies. Otherwise, never again becomes a very provincializing, even identitarian kind of slogan, as it's sometimes used. So this has been an intra-left debate. The second observation I want to make is that, again, while this is often seems to be mobilized from the left as well as debated on the left, as we now see, it's also, whoops, I need to, here we go. I think that in some ways the comparison starts, or at least starts simultaneously on the right. So there is a kind of, and it's not always done in quite the explicit discursive way it's done on the left. It's done with rhetoric, it's done with gesture, as you can see here. And for me, this became very clear very soon after the US election in November 2016, when there was the infamous speech by the quote unquote alt-right neo-fascist Richard Spencer, in which he said, among other things, hail Trump, hail our people, hail victory, right? Translations from the original German, as we say. And as you can see, the audience responded in kind with these gestures, right? Famous Nazi salute. So I guess my point here is that the right itself is very self-consciously deploying comparison to this period as well. It's not just a weapon of the left, it's something that's actually embraced. Doesn't mean we should take it at face value by any means, but I think we should take it seriously. And one of the things that you start to see when you start to think about comparison from the right, and here I give the other kind of, I think, very clear example that's been on a lot of people's minds over the last few years, is that precisely that kind of juxtaposition or comparison between anti-Semitism and anti-Blackness starts to come into view and starts to attain a new kind of visibility and plausibility by virtue of these right-wing comparisons. So you will all remember, I'm sure, the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville in 2017, in which you see, as in this image, right, displays of Nazi imagery as well as Confederate flags, and the famous, now infamous chant, Jews will not replace us. And a lot of people reacted to this with a certain amount of surprise. And the surprise is surprising on the one hand, but also not, I think, important to think about. Why were people surprised? People were surprised that white supremacists were anti-Semitic at the same time that they were racist and anti-Black. And of course, that's odd if you stop and think about it. But I think it says something about what I've called just a moment ago, the sort of renewed visibility, the renewed plausibility of this analogy between anti-Semitism and anti-Blackness. And I think the surprise registers the fact that until recently, I think most Jews have felt quite comfortable and quite safe, right? And that the process of becoming white is well achieved. And so I think that surprise registers something symptomatic and not totally wrong about that change. Nevertheless, I think what we see here is there's a kind of new plausibility and a new visibility to this comparison, to this juxtaposition. The final observation I want to make here in the first part is that this discourse of right-wing comparison is itself not new, or what I'm calling right-wing comparison is not new. And it actually, there's a historical perspective that needs to come in. And here I'm thinking specifically of the work of James Whitman. On the one hand, his book, Hitler's American Model, which showed that the Nazis themselves were interested, again, in this comparative move. They were studying US race law, US history, as they were formulating the Nuremberg race laws. And so they saw a kind of, and they didn't simply imitate them, right? The story is more complicated than that. It's an interesting story, in fact, troubling story, I think, for people here in the US. And the point here, again, is not comparison, is not about equation. It's about juxtaposition, analogy, bringing into relation. And so the Nazis were doing that. They were thinking in comparative terms. And another thing I was thinking about in this regard is the series of articles published by Sarah Churchwell that some of you may know, including this one on American fascism, another really wonderful essay. I think it was in the New Statesman this time. These are both, this one was from the New York Review, on The Plot Against America, Philip Roth's novel, and the TV series that was made about it. And Churchwell is answering directly to Moyne's argument about the American genealogy. And she says, yes, there is an American genealogy, but the American genealogy is also fascist, right? That the Ku Klux Klan and other white supremacist groups growing out of the 19th century and early 20th century are very plausibly understood as themselves fascist. And here you see Langston Hughes, right? Black American poet, himself also making this connection and seeing this connection. So Churchwell does, I think, important, as does Whitman, they do important genealogical work for seeing how some of these contemporary juxtapositions have a historical depth. And so that leads me to a couple of conclusions for this section. And one of them is that the comparison discourse is at its most interesting and potentially productive, I think, when it goes beyond analogy and starts to think about actual historical material connections and entanglements. And here I'm thinking not just of Whitman and Churchwell, but actually of some work that's being done right now by my student, Ben Ratzkoff, who's writing a really important dissertation on Black intellectuals' responses to Nazism in the 30s and early 40s. So people I've done and other people have done a lot of work on the memory of the Holocaust and how Black intellectuals intervened there. What Ben Ratzkoff is doing is actually looking at the very moment itself and the way that Black intellectuals were seeing both connections and differences and situating them in a larger kind of global historical framework. And I think that's really important work. The other thing I take from this is that it's really important when we're thinking about comparisons, when we're comparing comparisons, to think about how the subjects of comparison, in other words, those who are making the comparisons, are implicated in the act of comparison themselves. So subject position matters. And that's something that will come out in my second case study if I get a chance to talk more about that. So it's useful to compare comparisons and to think of the comparison controversy as a kind of genre or discursive event. So I want to quickly talk a little bit in the next few minutes about a German case or two German cases, a comparative German case. And I want to juxtapose diachronically here a very famous debate that happened in the 1980s called the Historikerstreit, known to many, or the Historians' Debate, as it's translated often into English. It took place in 1986, 1987, primarily, involving people like Ernst Nolte, who you see on the left, and Jürgen Habermas, the middle image there. And I want to juxtapose that with a very recent event, a 2020 comparison controversy, about the work of the Cameroonian, South Africa-based scholar Achille Mbembe, which took place primarily in Germany, though with some international scope as well this spring and summer. You'll remember that the Historikerstreit was a debate about the singularity of the Holocaust and the possibility of comparing it. The Mbembe affair, and after this image, I think I'll turn off the PowerPoint and just speak directly to you. The Mbembe affair was initiated when a politician from the FDP, this is the sort of liberal in the European sense political party in Germany, Lorenz Deutsch, sent an open letter to the director of the Ruhr Triennial, where Mbembe was supposed to be speaking, accusing him of Holocaust relativization, anti-Semitism, and denying Israel's right to exist. All of these, I think, are very problematic accusations. If you look at the evidence, I can talk a little bit more about that later. You'll see in his open letter, it starts with an epigraph from Barry Weiss about left-wing anti-Semitism in English. And this is a German letter, but a lot of the evidence he brings is actually in English, which is itself interesting. And I think this notion of a left-wing anti-Semitism may be something that we'd want to talk about a little bit more later as well, as we think about some of these comparative questions. I'm going to stop the share now and then just try to talk to you a little bit directly. So the And David, feel free to interrupt me if I've gone on too long, because I do want to make sure we have time for conversation. So the Historiker Streit. In the Historiker Streit, comparison was a conservative weapon used to relativize the Holocaust. So it started essentially when Nolte and other German right-wing nationalist German historians put forward the idea that the Holocaust was not only not singular, but was in some sense an imitation and of and response to the Gulag and to Stalinist terror. And Nolte even suggested that in fact, the Holocaust was a kind of self-defense because the Jews had in fact declared war on Nazi Germany. So it was legitimated in that way. Habermas, of course, responded very, very strongly to this and suggested that what was happening was an attempt by the right in the Helmut Kohl era to rewrite the national narrative, right? To take away German responsibility while taking away the uniqueness of the Holocaust. And so Habermas sort of struck back and argued for the importance of holding on to the singularity of the Holocaust, making it a central and unavoidable part of the German national narrative. And one of the things I found interesting in thinking back to the Historiker Streit in the new context is the fact that very quickly after the controversy sort of died down, the historical context changed so dramatically, right? It was the Berlin Wall came down, Germany was unified, and it's precisely in that period of the 1990s into the early 2000s when Habermas's position really becomes instantiated as the dominant official narrative of Germany. So in other words, in the 1980s, that notion of the singularity of the Holocaust and its centrality to the German national narrative was still in formation and it was still somewhat controversial. By the time you get into the 90s and 2005, when the Memorial to the Murdered Jews of Europe opens in Berlin, that has become official policy. It has become essentially a kind of uncontested position. If you then jump ahead to our current moment, you'll see that formerly recently uncontested position has itself started to become contested again, and sort of from two different directions. I think this is important. On the one hand, from the right, you have again a kind of right-wing attempt to relativize the Holocaust by people from the AfD, right? The far-right party who's made it into parliament and regularly makes comments about the need to kind of undo the Holocaust memory regime. But I think it's also been challenged in a different way from the left. And here the question of comparison starts to come in, because there have been a lot of calls by Black Germans, by Namibians, by others with an interest in this to start to take account of other German histories and to juxtapose the Holocaust with the history of German colonialism, among other things. And so there's a kind of opening up that's called for that comes from the left at the same time that there's a kind of relativization that comes from the right. And it's in that context that the Mbembe controversy takes place. And just to sort of do this quickly, it started with that open letter, this call to disinvite Mbembe from this important lecture by this relatively unknown politician. It was then taken up, however, Lorenz Deutsch's position was taken up by Felix Klein, who is the commissioner for Jewish life and the fight against anti-Semitism in Germany. That's his official title. And he essentially confirmed, affirmed rather, Deutsch's accusations against Mbembe and said, yes, this is an example of anti-Semitism. This is an example of Holocaust relativization. What is it exactly that Mbembe had done? And they were drawing almost entirely on just a couple of short pieces of writing by Mbembe. And they were looking at places where he juxtaposes, on the one hand, Israeli policy in the occupied territories with the apartheid regime. Remember, he's based in South Africa. In another passage, he's juxtaposing the apartheid and the Holocaust as two regimes of what he's calling radical separation. Now, in my reading of the passages to which they refer, there is no sense of equation between these different histories. In other words, a kind of anti-Palestinianism, anti-Semitism, and anti-Blackness. There is certainly juxtaposition. There is certainly connection within a kind of overarching framework of power and domination and racist violence. But he's always, in my mind, careful to differentiate. If you remember back to my initial sort of schema I posted, it's definitely in the differentiated corridor. And in my mind, it's done in the interest of creating solidarity across different victim groups, across different histories. And that's how I would situate it. So what's happened here? I think what's interesting in comparing these two comparison controversies is that the political valence of comparison seems to have radically changed, right? So in the 1980s, comparison was squarely on the side of the conservatives. And Habermas's progressive position was anti-comparative, right? It was a defense of the singularity of the Holocaust. In the current moment, the progressive position, if you want to associate it with Mbembe's and those who defended them, and I'll say that I was one of them, it's a pro-comparison perspective. The conservative position, on the other hand, is now anti-comparative, if I can put it that way. And the political lines are a little more complex. To talk about that later, but for the purposes of simplification, there seems to be an inversion there that's taken place. So what's going on here? I think you have to look behind the question of comparison, and what you find is the question of historical and political responsibility. And here the picture looks a little bit different. So in the 80s, the conservative positions used comparison in order to refuse to evade responsibility. Habermas evoked singularity in order to claim German responsibility for the Holocaust. Today, the conservative position still now embraces responsibility for the Holocaust, but it does that in order to evade responsibility for other sorts of implications that Germans and Germany might find themselves entangled in, right? So it's a way of instrumentalizing responsibility for the Holocaust in order to evade responsibility, say, for German colonialism, or for the role that Germany plays in contributing in whatever indirect ways to the continuing occupation of Palestine and the oppression of Palestinians. So responsibility is embraced but instrumentalized. I'm gonna wrap up in just a couple of minutes. And on the left side then, you go from a rejection of comparison in Habermas's case to an embrace of comparison. What about the question of responsibility, right? Habermas's position was pro-responsibility for the Holocaust, obviously. It seems to me very clear that if you look especially at the German intellectuals like Alaida Asman, Misha Brumlich, and others who have been defending Mbembe in this controversy, there is no sense in which they are trying to evade or to downplay German responsibility for the Holocaust, right? Rather, what you have is something that I would call a sort of multi-directional responsibility, a multiplication of responsibility, where there's a recognition that it's not a zero-sum game, that you can hold on to this important sense of historical responsibility that Germans rightly have for the Nazi genocide, but that you can add to that, that you can pluralize, that you can recognize that there are other histories at stake. The controversy then is about comparison, but it's ultimately really about something else. It's about responsibility. And one of the things that it also does is I think it does shed a kind of interesting light back on Habermas's position, which again, I think was the right position in the historical strife, but we also come to see was historically limited, right? That part of Habermas's position was that we need to hold on to this responsibility in order to join the political culture of the West. That's his phrase. And so in doing that, he wasn't able to make the sort of next critical move, which is to say that the political culture of the West also brings with it other problems, right? And it's those problems precisely that are starting to emerge, I think, in the more recent comparative moves, where questions of European imperialism and German colonialism are coming into play, where Israel and the Israeli-Palestinian question have started to attain a new kind of prominence, which you don't really find in the 1980s. And where you see anti-Semitism more explicitly being instrumentalized here against Mbembe, while in the 80s, as far as I've been able to tell, and I need to keep digging back into this, though Nolte, it was very clearly an anti-Semite, and Saul Friedlander, the historian, actually writes about that, accusations of anti-Semitism didn't play a very big role in that controversy. And I think it's interesting that those have now become politicized in a new way. So of course you can compare. The question is how you compare and why you compare. So even Nolte's comparison of Hitler and Stalin, of the Holocaust and the Gulag, is not itself out of bounds, right? Is not itself impossible. The question is, how do you make that comparison and why are you making that comparison? And I think that's where the important ethical and political questions start to come in. I'm gonna stop there and I'll look forward to discussion.
Thank you very much, Michael. It's customary at moments like this to say that was a very rich and fascinating and engaging talk, but that was a very rich, fascinating and engaging talk. I will ask just one question. There are about 100 of us here. If you do have questions that you'd like me to put to Michael Rothberg, please put them in the chat function and I'll do my best. But I'd like to get things going by asking Michael if you could say a bit more about the change, if you like, in the historical moment from 1986 and the Historica strike to the moment of the Mbembe affair.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a lot that happened in that time. And it's partly a historian's question to think about when did things change?
Yeah.
Now, one of the few advantages of having a seminar like this in this medium is that as you were talking, I was able to go to my bookshelf and pull down a book and see when it was.
I think that's called cheating, but okay.
And so I cheated and I pulled down Tony Judt's Post-War. And that was published as late as 2005. And that struck me as interesting because Judt was very important, it seems to me, in his last chapter in that book, which talks about Holocaust memory in the post-Cold War context. Mm. It's not about these post-colonial connections. Yeah. It's about recognizing the genocide of the Jews as the price that East European nations had to pay to be admitted to the European family after the fall of the Berlin Wall and after the collapse of the Warsaw Pact. So that dating of it, 2005, just raises a question to me, just to sort of push you a little bit on when do you think things changed and what can one say about why things changed?
Right. That's a really fascinating question and a really big question, obviously. And I have a few thoughts, but that would require, you know, a lot more discussion and also people with other kinds of expertise than the kinds that I have, which doesn't really travel so much to Eastern Europe. I guess that I would say, I mean, what I'm proposing in the talk that I just gave, and there is a kind of a written version of the part on Mbembe that was published in a blog post and called Comparing Comparisons. What I propose there is that there were at least two significant changes since the historiker strike that we can if we were going to periodize. We have a sort of pre-Berlin Wall phase of the 80s. We have a post-Berlin Wall phase that would go through the 90s, at least through 2005. So the 2005 date is interesting because, again, as I mentioned, that's also the date of the Berlin Memorial, as well as Judd's book, For What It's Worth. Mm-hmm. And then we have the most recent period. And I'm not trying to argue again that there's a sort of hard break in 2016. That seems too simplistic. But certainly in the last several years, we do seem to be in a new phase. Among the changes that, and so, Let me say something about the post-Cold War Eastern Europe piece of it, again, where I don't have a lot of expertise. But this would relate to my very final point, which is that I think in that post-Cold War moment, obviously this comparison that Nolte was using in the 80s became very important, right? We had to start thinking about Hitler and Stalin juxtaposed with each other. We had to start thinking about the Gulag and the Nazi camps. And that sort of thing. And that's what people certainly in Eastern Europe were demanding. And that's a very tricky and complicated question, obviously. And I'm not gonna give any kind of definitive answer, but I think it touches on my last point, which is that it wasn't the comparison itself, which was the problem mm-hmm. in Nolte's it was Nolte's particular articulation of it. It was the political affect associated with it. And it was the underlying reason for it, which was a relativization of responsibility and an attempt to create a new national narrative. I think what's happened in Eastern Europe is very complicated, and other colleagues can speak more to this. I think you have a series of these kinds of comparison controversies going on, and a struggle to find the right way to remember and think about the Holocaust alongside the oppression that people lived through under the Soviet period. And that means also addressing very difficult questions about complicity and implication of people in parts of Eastern Europe with the Nazi genocide as well, right? And so these are very tangled questions. So that's really tricky. But I think that's what we need to kind of work through is precisely these questions of comparison, how, why, for what purpose, with what ultimate result. Otherwise, I think in thinking about the relationship between the historical strike and the Mbembe affair, what we see is a kind of globalization of Holocaust memory that's taken place. The historical strike was very much a German debate among German intellectuals, even more specifically, men of a particular generation, people who had at least some childhood experience of the National Socialist period. That's primarily who the debate was among. Nolte, Habermas, Sturmer, Hillgruber, all of those people born in the 20s and maybe 30s, all men. Misha Brumlik is the only one who seems to have been in both affairs and was one of the only prominent Jewish voices within Germany at the time in the 80s, as far as I know. Today, there's a kind of interesting internationalization, which I think, and pluralization of the participants. So it's a new generation, other than Brumlik, it's an entirely an entirely new generation, and it's certainly a post-war generation, right? The people involved in the people like Elida Osman, Brumlik himself, these are post-Nazi, people born in the post-Nazi period, growing up in the post-Nazi period. It's also more gender equitable. There have been prominent women's voices like Elida's, Susan Nyman, Eva Eluz. And as some of those other names also suggest, it hasn't been a discussion only among Germans. It's been an international discussion, not just because of Mbembe himself, but because others of us have gotten involved. And then finally, the histories at stake are not only German histories, right? If the historical strike was, I suppose, not only about German history, because it also brought in the Soviet question, but it was certainly very much a European-centered debate. The one today brings in South Africa, it brings in Israel, Palestine. So there's been a kind of pluralization and globalization at various scales and in various parts of the controversy. And I think that is symptomatic of the era in which we live.
Thanks, Michael.
I hope that gets to some of what you were,
No, I mean, exactly. So a very thoughtful response. So I have a number of questions here from others, and I'll try to get through as many of them as possible. The first came from Adam Sutcliffe.
Hi, Adam, an old friend.
Of course you are. who says he has two questions, but I think he's selling me only one here. But he writes, isn't the central political issue in relation to the policing of Trump fascism comparisons and those of Mbembe, Israel? Isn't it all about Israel? Those who see Trump as a friend of Israel in a good way or don't want to upset those who are seeing things that way are those who are most determined to rule out comparisons of Nazism and the Holocaust being made by progressives. Yeah. The challenge then is for us to call out clearly the aggressive outriding of this view, Adam.
Yeah, thanks, Adam. The answer is yes and no, I guess, for me. I think in the German case, in the Mbembe affair, I think that is very, very central, the Israel question and the absolute inability to really have an open discussion about Israeli policy in Germany, or at least that's my sense of things. And that might be exaggerated, but I think there are very strong strictures on the kinds of criticism, the kinds of positions one is allowed to take around Israel, especially in Germany. And the excuse that's given is that it's going to relativize responsibility for the Holocaust. And that's where I think this pluralized sort of multi-directional notion of Holocaust responsibility plus is really important. That what I'm hoping can happen in the German public sphere is an understanding that by adding other forms of implication, as I like to call them, you are not actually giving up on the centrality of the Holocaust for thinking about post-war German identity, but you're pluralizing those forms of implication. I think that's really important. I think it has a lot to do with Israel. In the US, I think it's a bit more complicated. I don't think, and that's why I wanted to point to that intra-left debate. I don't think that's what Moyne is about. I don't think that's what some of the other left-wing critiques of the fascist analogy are about at all. I think they're much more about what they see as an exceptionalization of Trump, which takes him out of the larger political culture as it's developed in the United States and produced him. So they're more interested in how was Trump possible than why is Trump so evil? Right. And I think Sarah Churchwell's response was a good one, and I think addresses some of this by saying, yes, 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 we can look to an American genealogy and we can still call it fascist, right? Because that's what white supremacy is or might be thought of as. I think there is also a larger point about the enabling of Trump, which isn't just about that sort of genealogy of the Klan, et cetera, et cetera. So while I think that, you know, in the example that I gave there of the Anti-Defamation League and the American Jewish Committee, there I would agree with Adam's point that in some ways Israel probably lurks behind this or may potentially lurk behind this. I don't think that's true across the board. I think actually the picture is more complicated, and that's what I'm still trying to tease out. But certainly I do think it's a very central part of that recent debate in Germany and ongoing debates in Germany. And it plays a role in the US as well.
Thanks, Michael. Have a question from Rachel Seifert, who also says, excellent talk, thank you. I feel like a radio host here. And who's reading out letters from listeners. Excellent talk, thank you. As the granddaughter of Nazis and the great-granddaughter of German colonialists involved in the Herero genocide, I was most interested in your assertion that responsibility can be plural. It seems to me to be essential work ahead for Germany. Do you see significant pushback against this position?
I guess I do see pushback against this position. Against the pluralizing position. I mean, I do think that's what the Mbembe debate was about. So here I would say back to Adam's question as well, not only about Israel, also about German colonialism, right? So I don't think we should reduce everything to Israel. There are other tensions and controversies and histories that need to come into this that are also important. I do have a slightly optimistic read on the recent debate though. I do think that there is more space we're starting to recognize that history of German colonialism. And I think this is an ongoing struggle, obviously. But I think really on the ground, grassroots, anti-racist activists in Germany and also scholars have been making some real progress. And I'm thinking here, for example, about the street renaming projects, which have had some successes, including successes recently. I think the question of German colonialism is much, much more in the public sphere, much, much more a matter of debate than it had been, certainly in the 80s when the Historiker strike was going on, where as far as I know, it was not very present at all. And so you have people like the historian Jürgen Simmerer, who've been speaking about this, who have a quite prominent public profile. So I think that I'd say this is still a work in progress, this claiming of multiple forms of responsibility. I think there's still a lot of nervousness about it. Some of that I think is genuine, right? In other words, I do think part of it comes out of the strength of German memory culture as it's developed. But I also think it can be kind of deflecting from some of these other questions like taking responsibility for colonialism, having a different position on the Israeli-Palestinian question, et cetera, et cetera. So I think we're in a position, I guess what I'd say is we're in a moment of transition there, which doesn't mean it's necessarily going to go in the right direction, but I'm somewhat hopeful that it will, and that there will be there's an opportunity to get past this very rigid uniqueness discourse and to open that up into a plural form of responsibility. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. I have another question from Amy Sanders, who asks, Michael, you talked about how the Habermas argument became the accepted official uncontested position of Germany when Germany united. You then referenced those that defended Mbembe and those that defended the Mbembe case and thereby defend the possibility of comparison. Mm-hmm. Are we at a stage when that will become the accepted and dominant discourse that comparison can be useful? Right. Is this made more likely by the Black Lives Matter movement?
Right, that's a great question. I think it's a question that's related to the previous question. And I guess I would give it a somewhat similar answer, which is, I don't think that this, again, pluralized conception of responsibility and memory is yet fully accepted. I certainly don't think it's the dominant position right now, at least among elites. But I think it has a lot of momentum, perhaps, coming out of these kinds of grassroots efforts, as well as intellectual efforts. I think it's interesting that precisely this period between the Historiker Streit and the Mbembe affair has been also the moment when there's been a blossoming of comparative genocide studies, right? So I think on the scholarly level, as well as on the sort of grassroots activist level, a lot has been happening in this period. But I think it's still, I wouldn't say that it's attained a position of acceptance in Germany. And someone sort of on the ground in Germany could maybe speak to this better than I could, but that is my sense observing it from where I am. Was there another piece? Oh, so Black Lives Matter. I mean, I do think it does seem to me, and again, I'm observing from afar, that, I mean, obviously Black Lives Matter has had a global impact, and I'd say that's a very positive global impact. My sense, and here again, it's a distant sense, about what's happened in some situations though, including Germany, is that the prominence of Black Lives Matter could still go in two directions. In other words, it could become a way of, again, deflecting responsibility for local forms of racism by saying, oh, this is an American problem, right? And I think this has happened sometimes in Germany, like, oh my goodness, look what's happening in the US. It's terrible. And it is terrible for sure. And I think trying to find the right word, not the goal, not the job, but the what activists have tried to do in that context, what especially Black activists and people of color in Germany have tried to do, is to use that as an opportunity to say, hey, wait a second, Black Lives Matter is relevant not just in Minneapolis for George Floyd, for Trayvon Martin, et cetera, et cetera. We have cases in Germany and have had cases in Germany over many years, over decades, which are very similar in some ways and that have not been recognized, again, prominently by German elites and in the German public sphere. So I think there's a kind of, it seems to me, there's a kind of struggle over what the meaning of Black Lives Matter is going to be in Germany. And this may be happening in other places like the UK as well. I don't know enough to be able to say that. Is this going to be interpreted as an American movement, or is this going to be interpreted as a movement with very real local significance, pointing to very real local problems of racism and police violence? And I think that's the struggle that's going on right now, and I think that's ongoing.
I have a question from my colleague, Brendan McGeever, who says, many thanks for this hugely interesting paper, Michael. From teaching and thinking about these issues in the UK in recent years, I wondered whether there remains a progressive opposition to comparisons. I'm thinking, for example, about some Black radical oppositions to comparisons with contemporary anti-Semitism.
Yeah.
Similarly, there are some on the left who insist on the specificity of anti-Semitism, and not only that, but that the comparison model stands in the way of grasping that specificity. I'm thinking, for example, about anti-Deutsch accounts, which even insist that anti-Semitism is not a form of racism. These perspectives are alive and well in the classroom today and in movements too. So I wondered how well established the trend was that you correctly identify of a progressive embrace of comparisons and the conservative rejection.
Right. Yeah, no, that's a great point, and I agree with it entirely. I do think that the political field is more complicated than what I suggested. Again, in the German case, yeah, the anti-Deutscher, I mean, I think the anti-Deutscher position, what's strange here, I don't think that's a real leftist position, for one. I just don't see how that's an actual leftist position. And I actually think it's become surprisingly mainstream. And that's, and I, so I think someone like Felix Klein, right, the commissioner for the fight against anti-Semitism, and the Bundestag, for example, in their anti-BDS resolution, have basically embraced sort of anti-Deutsch positions, and those have become somewhat mainstream. But those aren't, for me at least, those are not precisely left positions. But I was trying to suggest in the first part of the talk, in the US context, that definitely the question of comparison is contested on the left, right? At least the particular, I don't think overall, I don't think Sam Moyn is anti-comparison as such. I think he's articulating a particular situated critique of comparison, the critique of fascism. And he's asking also, what good are these kinds of comparisons? And I think those are good questions, even though I find myself more on the pro-comparison side. I think Moyn makes some really important points there. But you're right that there are other forms of sort of leftist anti-comparativism. And the one I thought of was Afro-pessimism, right, which really sees anti-Blackness as precisely a unique phenomena, a very specific phenomena. And so that even comparisons with indigenous peoples, even comparisons with Palestinians are rejected, right, on the basis of the sort of global uniqueness of anti-Blackness. I guess I think that's a really important provocation. I think it has to be taken seriously. I guess ultimately, it's a position that I'm not going to hold myself, right? That I am going to try to argue that one can be comparative, but also hold on to specificity. And I guess, so I prefer to uniqueness because I think uniqueness has become so sacralized, at least in the context of the Holocaust, that it's been taken outside of history. So I try to, I wouldn't use words like uniqueness, and even singularity is a little bit tricky. But certainly I talk about specificity and particularity. And I guess what I'm trying to offer, and this already goes back to my book, Multidirectional Memory, is a vision in which you can hold on to particularity and specificity and also be comparative, right? That in fact, we only see specificity, we only see particularity when we juxtapose, when we compare. And that act of comparison and juxtaposition does not have to erode specificity and even singularity. So that's my position. Now, whether that's a hegemonic position, no, I don't think it is. Whether it could be, I don't know. I mean, I'm trying, my intervention in, for example, the Mbembe affair has been precisely around trying to put that idea out there to try to get Germans especially to understand that you can give up the sacralized notion of the Holocaust uniqueness, but still hold on to its specificity and even its centrality, that we can have, let's say, multiple centers of German responsibility. And in fact, that's what history gives to us. And I'm not trying to pick on Germans specifically, because as an American, this is very, you know, very important and intimate to me as well. I can't imagine saying there's one form of historical responsibility that as a US citizen I would have, when I know that there's a whole series and an ongoing series of histories that I am implicated in, both historically and contemporarily. And so my vision, again, my vision of implication is one, like my vision of multidirectional memory, of a kind of multiplication of forms of responsibility. But is it hegemonic yet? No, I don't think it is.
We are running out of time, and I'm not going to get through all of the questions, but I am going to run two questions into each other, because they're quite broad questions. One is methodological, one talks about your work as a whole, Michael. So Nancy Alchem writes, on many occasions, Israeli politics towards Palestinians is compared to Nazi behavior towards Jews. Comparison thus becomes a weapon of provocation to gain public support. You suggest multidirectional memory as a solution or a way out of these kinds of battles, but it has been interpreted as naive when it comes to contemporary conflicts. How can we allow for comparison for effect without establishing a hierarchy of suffering and mutual accusations? And we have just the final question that I'll throw in at the same time from Darius Stoller. Hi, Darius. Very good to have you here. Michael, thank you. Very interesting speech. When judging a comparison, do you ask for intentions of the person who makes it or for a tendency inherent in this comparison that may be different to the intention? Right. We often do not know the intentions of a person making a comparison.
Right.
So I think two really great questions to end with.
Absolutely. Terrific questions. I mean, on the question of this, you know, really quite common, even ubiquitous comparison between Israeli policy and Nazi policy, this was really the center of my essay From Gaza to Warsaw. And so I would really sort of refer people to that, because I try to work this out with some care. And I do, and I picked that precisely as a way of thinking in more complicated ways of what I was calling multidirectional memory, because it struck me and still strikes me as one of the hardest cases. At least for me, it's a very, very difficult case and very difficult to work through. And that's what led me to that kind of schema that I shared at the beginning, this mapping of multidirectional memory in the interests of an ethics of comparison, where I distinguish these four quadrants, you know, based on sort of equation versus differentiation, and competition versus solidarity. And what I try to show in the essay is that while this analogy is between Israeli policy and Nazi policy, it's frequently abused and frequently used in ways that I would reject and find very disturbing. There are ways of doing it. There are different ways of doing it, and that those have different ethical and political implications. And that what I ultimately argue for, and here it's sort of my own, you know, I offer this as a kind of mapping, which you can do in a quasi-objective way, potentially, but subjectively, where I ultimately situate myself is in this quadrant I call differentiated solidarity. And that's the idea that we can juxtapose, we can bring into relationship different histories of violence. We can do that without collapsing them into each other. In other words, we can recognize their fundamental historical differences, but we can do that in the interests of creating solidarity between different victim groups. And you know, I think that the reason I think that's important, that sort of particular quadrant of differentiated solidarity is important, is because I think we often believe that in order to establish solidarity, we need to do it based on sameness and identification. And so I think the kind of liberal model of solidarity is in this sort of equation solidarity quadrant. And what I'm, and I think that comes with various kinds of pitfalls, various kinds of erasures of power differentials, as well as material historical differences. But I think if we can kind of move ourselves or think about this quadrant of differentiated solidarity, it gives us a kind of space to think about potential connections between histories without collapsing them into each other. And I think especially in these sorts of controversial cases, that's a really important, at least goal to kind of hold up as something to try to attain. In terms of Daria Stola's question, that's also a really good question. I mean, I'm a literary critic. Literary critics are not supposed to believe in intention, right? We have what we call the intentional fallacy. When we're reading a literary text, we're not really interested in what the author thinks they're doing. We're interested in what the text is actually doing. And I guess that's would probably be my position here as well. When we analyze these comparisons, we have to work with the evidence that we have. Now, sometimes we do have evidence of intentionality. And so I think even in literary studies, we've started to sort of take that into account as well. If an author writes a long comment about what they think they were doing, we take that into account. We don't take that into account as the truth of the matter, right? But we take that into account as another form of evidence that we can factor in. And I suppose I would want to do something similar with this question of comparison. So like thinking back to Nolte, for example, you know, Nolte was a serious scholar in many ways, and you could look at his comparisons and evaluate them as such. But then you also have some evidence that suggests, you know, intentionality behind them as well. So I guess what I would say is you ultimately have to look at the tendencies of the comparisons themselves. If you have evidence of intentionality, you can certainly factor them in. And I think that's actually maybe an important point with respect to especially some of these far right comparisons, because they often present themselves as if they were jokes, right? As if, I'm making a Nazi reference, but I'm not really serious. And I think we have to cut through that. And in some ways, I do think we have to speculate about or even try to figure out the intentions behind it, because we can't take some of those things at face value. Otherwise, I think we fall into a trap that they are setting. So I guess it's a delicate question in a certain sense, and I would take it on a case by case basis. But it's an important question. I need to think more about it.
Well, thank you so much, Michael. I'd like to thank everyone who's come along this evening to this webinar. I confess it's rather strange talking into the I'm into the blackness, but I can absolutely tell from all the comments in the chat panel how much Michael's talk has been appreciated, how much it has stimulated people. Fabulous, thank you so much, and so forth, are among the comments which people have left. Michael, I couldn't have asked for a better, more stimulating start to our webinar series. Thank you very much. We are hugely in your debt.
Thank you. I'm really glad to have been able to do this and appreciate all the really, really great questions.
Thank you. You may now leave the room. Whatever happens now.